Дочери Путина. Журналисты рассекретили...
Катерина Тихонова. Казалось бы, ребенок занимается наукой, инновациями.
Состояние оценивается примерно в 2 миллиарда долларов.
Вы сейчас видите виллу Биарицы, в которой живут молодые люди.
Почему Путин скрывает своих детей?
Его пресс-окружение нет какой-то контр-игры.
They run banks, pension funds and electric companies. They're oil and gas executives. They're worth billions and most of them are under 40. Meet the children of Vladimir Putin's cronies. A new nobility is being born in Russia as Generation P, the offspring of those in Putin's inner sanctum, come of age, come into their own, and seek to inherit their parents' power. But if the past century of Russian history is any guide, this effort to establish a de facto hereditary aristocracy is likely doomed to fail. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks very much. Hey, guys.
We're doing it over the Skype this time, not face-to-face like last week. Joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog, and host of the SRB podcast, which I had the honor of appearing on yesterday. Welcome back, Sean. Good to have you.
Good to be back.
Good to have you back. So Reuters published this widely discussed investigative report this week looking at the children of the Russian elite. It focused mainly on Katerina Tikhonova, the widely believed to be Putin's daughter, and her husband, Kirill Shamalov, the son of longtime Putin crony Nikolai Shamalov, of course. It also looked at the upwardly mobile careers of the children of Kremlin Chief of Staff Sergei Ivanov, Security Council Secretary Nikolai Patrushev, longtime Putin cronies Arkady Rotenberg and Yuri Kovalchuk and others. Sociologist Olga Krishnovskaya, who studies the Kremlin elite, told Reuters that a new aristocracy was emerging, with a second generation inheriting the status of the current circle around Putin. But not so fast, argued State Duma Deputy Dmitry Gudkov in an article in Vedomosti. In the past century, there wasn't a single generation of Russian elites that left power voluntarily, that wasn't killed, supplanted, exiled, or at best marginalized with contempt, Gudkov wrote. He continued, the elite basically resets to zero every 20 to 25 years, starting over with a clean slate. Before long, either red ink or blood is spilled all over that list. Gudkov certainly has the history right. Do we have any reason to believe it'll be different this time, Mark?
Well, first of all, let me be a sort
contrarian.
Of academic.
Contrarian. Be contrarian.
Yeah, okay. Well, fair enough. But it's also, I mean, I'm trained in a historian, and I think one of the things you always learn is that while history is an extraordinarily valuable tool for understanding situations, one shouldn't regard it necessarily as a predictive one. And yes, when looking at the 20th century and sort of the progressive regimes eating their own or the previous elite, but how far this is actually just more about dramatic and cataclysmic regime change rather than necessarily the elite specifically. But that said, I think, yes, of course, we see an interesting process. But what to me is perhaps most interesting is that we have essentially a political elite whose kids are not going into politics, whose kids are actually
not
going
yet
into business. Well, not yet, but, you know, all we have to go on is what we see. They are getting obscenely rich. I mean, you know, the Tikhonova and Shamalov are meant to be worth $2 billion or so. And again, a lot of this is precisely, it's money that is not, I would be tempted to say, earned. It's precisely that it's handed either directly or more often it's just that they get very, very lucrative positions or, I mean, for example, you know, they end up acquiring big swaths of key strategic industries. But the fascinating thing is this, that in Russia today, money is not in itself power. Money is big dashers and a wonderful life today, but the point is money is merely held in trust for the state until the state wants it back or the state wants to reallocate it. And these people are not busy accumulating political power in their own right. They're still, as it were, under their parents' creche. They may be vastly rich, they may have multiple mansions, but in political terms, they're still living in their parents' attic bedrooms.
They're still in their 30s. And the thing that, one of the things that, that this got me thinking was you have to wonder about succession with this regime. And are they preparing the next generation? You know, is that what we're looking at here? Are they the new, is this the Kims of Russia? You know, are they to Russia what the Kims are to North Korea, as Gudkov glibly put it in his article?
Well, 2 points there. And then I'd be interested to hear what Sean thinks. I mean, one is that if one looks at the Kims, we're talking about just simply the, you know, the autocrat. We're not, I mean, actually, North Korea has a very high level of turnover within the elite because you can very, very quickly fall foul of this particularly murderous and unpleasant ruling dynasty. So if we're talking about elite, unless we're talking about elite in the sense of like one family, actually, North Korea is a bad example of this kind of succession. I mean, really, North Korea is just simply a murderous autocracy.
But the one other by thing one is, family. Right.
Yeah, exactly. But the other thing is, again, that there is at the moment no signs that these people are being groomed for political power. Yeah, of course. I mean, this is a state that could at any point just reach down and say, oh, by the way, this person, this 30-year-old rich kid whom you've never heard of is now Minister for X. Yeah, I mean, there are no constraints on the Kremlin in that respect. But we haven't seen any of the signs. I mean, these are not people who, on the whole, for example, are being touted as opinion formers. We're not seeing them particularly commenting on the issues of the day. All these things that anyway, regimes tend to do just to signal. These are the guys to watch, or guys and girls to watch. These are the people who actually are going to be your next generation leader. They don't seem interested in that. And so I think this is actually, for me, one of the interesting challenges is it that just the assumption is that at some point they will just naturally be slotted in and the Russian people don't need to be prepared for it, just, you know, to hell with them. They'll just take the leaders they're being told. But these people don't seem to be interested in that. Or is it that they're just simply thinking building up their money because money is wonderfully fungible, as long as you've got enough of it in your Swiss bank account or whatever, if need be, you can get the hell out? Or third option, is it that they're not even thinking about the future? I mean, I honestly don't know, because alas, I don't run in these sets, I must confess.
Now, I wanted to pick up on something you said earlier, is that we have a history of violent regime change, and this really explains why there's been no dynasties in Russia. And this points to the fact that Russia's historically had a problem with succession, or at least post-imperial Russia has had a problem with succession. I think, I guess, this is really what is at the heart of all this. But Sean, why don't you jump in here? What are your thoughts? I noticed you're writing.
I mean, both of these articles are pointing to two separate problems. I mean, the Reuters, or two separate issues. The Reuters article is pointing to the accumulation of wealth by the children of people that are around Putin, which is one issue. And the second, the Gudkov article is pointing to the need to regenerate the elite, the political elite in particular, not necessarily, well, the elite in general, but I think he's mostly concerned about the political elite. And yes, in the 20th century in Russia, the elite has been decimated three times, right? 1917, 1937, and then again in the 1990s. So the elite has had to completely regenerate after these three kind of cataclysmic events. So the elite hasn't been able to kind of sediment itself, say, like the Tsarist elite was able to do over a couple of centuries. But it does point to, I think, a chronic historical problem in Russia, and that is about succession. I mean, really, if you look at the long history of Russia, the only kind of smooth successions were in the 19th century. The rest of them were palace coups. There was jockeying. There was, of course, revolution. There was backroom fighting in the Bolshevik period. There were factional fights. And this is in very few instances did the elite kind of coalesce and come together to put forward a kind of representation of that class. One could say, to some extent, maybe Brezhnev and the last Soviet leaders to some extent represented that. Putin, to some extent, represented that, a kind of elite consensus of putting forward a representative. But I think it says something about the problem of kind of what I would call elite class consciousness in Russia. And that sense is that they are a class, but they're not a class that seeks to reproduce themselves. They're not a class that sees their interests as a whole. Say, if you compare, say, to the American elite, which may fight politically, but politics isn't a zero-sum game. They kind of have a general consensus on the big issues of the day, the state of the economy, the accumulation of wealth. They have rules in which, okay, yes, you take power, and then we step aside, a transfer of power. And in Russia, throughout its history, it tends to be far more cannibalistic, and the elite cannibalizing itself. And it does pose a question, and this goes to something that Mark said, and that is the children that are accumulating wealth around from the people around Putin's circle. In many ways, this is completely normative. I mean, that children of elite accumulate wealth is not exactly surprising. I doubt Chelsea Clinton, for example, had many obstacles in her life in getting to the position as she is today. The difference, though, is that there's two differences, and this points to what Mark said. In Russia, political power gets money, whereas in the West, money gets political power. And if you don't have political power, or your patrons don't have political power, you could lose your wealth in Russia. Just like as Mark said, it's in trust. And there also seems to be in Russia a taboo against this. The fact that we don't know these people aren't really touted as kind of celebrities of the elite. We don't know much about their background. Putin's daughters live in obscurity. We're not really sure of who their identity is. There seems to be something about not having this completely public.
But didn't you find it curious that they don't even want to admit that Tikhonova is his daughter?
No.
And this was such a controversy when, I mean, it's pretty much common knowledge, right?
Right. And none of them would comment on the fact of their position and their wealth. And what's interesting is, like, all of this is kind of falling into these children's laps. They're not, you know, quote unquote, earning it, if you want to apply that term. They're not going through the main institutions of kind of elite reproduction, universities and various institutes and various corporations. They're just kind of like landing, and things are being kind of, seems to be, kind of given to them just based on their connections through their parents, which are connected to Putin. But this does pose a major problem in the sense that I don't see, just like Mark does, I don't see these people being groomed, I mean, for political power. And this is actually similar to in the Soviet period. You didn't see a lot of the top leadership. I mean, if you look at the sons and daughters of the Politburo in the Soviet period, none of them really rose to great political ambition. Unlike, say, in Tsarist Russia, where you had something different. But these people aren't being – these kind of Putin's children or Putin's generation aren't being groomed for political power. So the question is – and this goes to the Gubko question – is, well, who's going to take their place? Mm-hmm. Who's going to take Putin's circle's place? Who's being groomed for this position?
Nobody is what it appears to be.
And it seems like nobody is.
Well, I want to – I mean, you make an interesting point about the continuous cannibalization of the elite. And the one exception to this rule, as you pointed out, was the Brezhnev period, which is known famously as the period of stagnation. So you have this dichotomy of either utter cannibalization or ossification and stagnation. Is the other? No, is that seems to be the choice one way or the other.
I think the stagnation part is more a condition of how open the doors are for the elite. Do you allow some kind of social mobility to create dynamism within
right.
it, or you just let people that class ossify,
right?
Well, kind of sit comfortable in their position without creating some sort of dynamism.
Mark, you want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to follow on that. I agree very much. The interesting thing is that precisely because, I mean, historically, it's not just now that power trumps wealth. And one aspect of that is precisely a lack of rule of law, as we would understand it, a lack of some option whereby you can hold on to your resources even when you're no longer politically powerful and bequeath those resources safely to the next generation. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons for the whole ossification in the Brezhnev era. No one dared retire, because as soon as you retire, not only do you lose all the perks that are part of your job, you know, you don't own the datcha and the house and everything else. It's just it goes with your job. But also, as soon as you're out, you're powerless. You are vulnerable to your enemies
right.
and such like. Well, and so, of course, people held on to that, and therefore they created no structure. So even though the Communist Party did have mechanisms for succession. They just weren't
I would add to that. I mean, according to, it's pretty much common knowledge. Now, the Brezhnev wanted to retire in 77 and was talked out of it, at least according to interviews I've seen on the subject. And it was, I think Brezhnev could have safely retired. But he, I guess those under him were worried about what they would lose if he retired.
And yeah, a lot of people may be feeling once Andropov was clearly the sort of the coming man.
Right.
You know, exactly. No, they knew in a way after a certain point that they couldn't actually stop the Andropov bandwagon, but a lot of them were terrified about quite what that would mean. So again, it's precisely because they didn't think, in a way, that in a Western system, and this is where I would slightly differ from Gudkov. I mean, he makes the point that, as it were, democracy.
Yeah, no, I wanted to ask you both about that point, because that's an interesting point.
And I think it's not so much democracy as what tends to go with it. I mean, in a way, part and parcel of a working democracy is precisely this sense of, you know, private property rights and a legal system that protects it. And that, I think, is what has always been lacking. Mm. And it goes back, I mean, even in Tsarist times. I mean, technically speaking, when you inherited, you didn't, you know, if you're an aristocrat, you didn't actually inherit. You technically had to go to the Tsar and say, excuse me, can I have my dad's fiefdom? And the Tsar would say, yes, of course. But even then, there was, at least formally speaking, the sense that it's all the Tsar's. Well, now, when it comes down to it, it's all the state's. You have it for now. And that's why, I mean, I love, Sean, that you sort of talked about a class consciousness, because in some ways we actually have a false consciousness within the poor downtrodden elite, in that they have been hegemonized in good Gramscian conditions, that they believe their interests are those of Putin's regime, when actually their interests precisely are not. Their interests are actually to encourage some shift to a system, because exactly, I mean, they have nothing to lose and everything to gain from democracy. Mm. As long as it comes with, you know, as part of a package,
right,
with profits and things.
Well, one of the things I was very surprised.
Well, can I,
go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, can I add something? I mean, yeah, I tend to kind of classify it in these kind of Marxist terms, in the sense the elite is a class of itself, but it's not a class for itself. And the rule of law, I mean, the rule of law and the kind of formal structures are incredibly important in establishing this tradition to kind of provide the legal protections guaranteed by the state for the transfer of wealth. But you could also have, and this goes to the question, does it necessarily need to be a democracy? You could also have informal rules that are culturally part of that class that allows for the transfer of wealth as well. It's always a bit tenuous, of course, because the rule of law and backed by the state doesn't necessarily protect it in the same way. But it's surprising to me that in the Russian case, you still don't even get the informal rules of kind of saying, okay, Vladimir Vladimirovich, you reigned for this long. It was great. You did a good job. You accumulated all this wealth. Your children had benefited. You have your circle. Now it's time to move on. Here's your retirement. Go run the International Olympics or whatever. You can still remain a backdoor advisor. We'll look to you for all sorts of, you know, advice. You're still a prominent statesman, blah, 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 blah. But it's time to go into retirement.
Well, don't you find it interesting that Gudkov didn't use the example of China? Because you kind of sort of described the Chinese system there, Sean.
Right.
And I mean, basically, you have 2 5-year terms and you're out. And
yeah,
you have elections within the Communist Party, within the Central Committee, to elect the leader, who is at the same time the president. But it's worked fairly well, and it works fairly stably. China doesn't have these succession crises that Russia has, not at least recently.
And it's interesting that the Chinese communists have better capitalist class consciousness than the Russian capitalist elite, which has more of a feudal consciousness.
Mm. Mark, anything to add there?
Well, if we're talking about China, one of the interesting things is what's going on now. Yes, up to maybe a year ago, I'd have agreed with you wholeheartedly. Now I would have to throw in the caveat that actually we see these increasingly far-reaching anti-corruption campaigns. And we know that anti-corruption campaigns are one of the primary instruments for purges and score settling in these systems where everybody is corrupt. And in fact, I'm wondering if this actually is precisely the
Is Xi Jinping turning into Putin, is what you're suggesting?
Well, not so much that. I'm actually wondering whether these are either the growing pains or just simply the pains of the Chinese model. Because, I mean, anyway, part of the reason why the Chinese system worked so well, and it absolutely, I agree with you, has, is precisely it was predicated on constant high levels of economic growth. So that you could afford to basically buy out successive generations of the elite and say, look, you could still, don't worry, there's still so much money around that absolutely you can go into comfortable sinecure and still have a really good life, and yet we can also bring in the new generation and give them a really good quality of life. In some ways, I mean, this is a little bit like the early Putin model.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Putin was as it were, in some ways shifting his resources in different ways. But, you know, part of the economic dynamism of the first two Putin terms was very much put just simply buying off elites, both current and new. And I think that's the crucial thing. But on the other hand, you know, when the money starts to run out, that's when things become much more zero sum. So China might be going that way. So anyway, I think you have to hesitate about anyway presenting China as this nice model. I mean, just that
that's been able to solve this problem of succession in an authoritarian state.
Yeah, but exactly. But only so long as the money keeps pouring in. I think this is one of the absolutely crucial challenge. It's easy to run almost any system when you've got lots of money. That's never a problem. It's how you deal with crisis situations. And for all their numerous flaws, Western democratic models actually are quite good at handling shocks.
Right.
They have resilience. They lose focus. I mean, they have all kinds of problems. But one thing they do have is high levels of resilience. Mm. And this is what the Russians are having to cope with now.
Well, one of the things I've been keeping my eye out for is elite recruitment in terms of like the effort to recruit a new generation of cadres into the elite, not the children of the inner circle, but a mid-level bureaucrats, because those are the people that ultimately will you would think rise to the higher levels. It was sometime last year I did a blog post on this about how Putin was actively recruiting, the security services were vetting, and they were trying to find the right type of bureaucrat to fit into the Putin system of his third term. I don't know if any of you recall this. I did a blog post called Putin's Class of 2014, which was playing off the class of 38. What do either of you see along these lines? Do you see anything in terms of elite recruitment? Because I haven't seen much more on this and how successful this has been. It's happening very quietly. That's probably the point. But I haven't seen much more in terms of elite recruitment to bring people up in the mid levels that would maintain some possibility for succession in the future. Ready?
I mean, I'd say the problem is this is mid level. It's fine. So you find the ambitious, smart, opportunist kids from the provinces, and you bring them in at the mid-level now, and that's fine. But in a way, they're not going to be the next generation of the upper elite, or they couldn't be the next generation of the upper elite, generally speaking, for what, 10, 15 years?
Right.
I mean, to go back to something that Sean said that I think is quite right about the fact that this generation, Generation P, is having it all given to them. And in some ways, this is an almost caricature of the usual sort of process. Because of the carnivorous nature of Soviet and then Russian politics, each generation of the elite has come in has actually been pretty good at what it does. Now, what it does might well actually be running a murder machine under Stalin, but they were good at it. We actually had, you know, because precisely it was this extraordinarily high-pressure Darwinistic environment that you, I mean, in some cases literally wouldn't survive if you weren't good at it. And therefore, you have successive generations that actually, in their own way, you know, we like to joke about and point to the very real inefficiencies, for example, of the Soviet system. But often the inefficiencies were in the areas they didn't really care about. So the masses don't get shoes that actually sort of fit and keep their soles. That's fine, though, because we've got nukes and we can put Sputnik in orbit. It was a system which actually was good at focusing resources on elite priorities. And the second generations aren't very good, but the point is there was this mechanism. Both the Chinese Communist Party and the Soviet Communist Party actually have structures whereby you have, as it were, ammunition in the magazine steadily being brought closer and closer to the breach.
Mm-hmm.
Here, well, maybe one could think about these middle-level people as that, but the point is that, as it were, there's almost a huge gap. that's fine for 10 years hence, maybe. Though I suspect these are still these are the next generation of Lavrovs, shall we say, rather necessarily than Ustinovs. I mean, I'm not sure if they're just simply sort of able, loyal functionaries. We don't know, precisely because they are unknown figures. But what I don't see is who 5 years hence could credibly be brought in, who has experience, who has some degree of political weight, and you know who would have anything more than just simply the Kremlin says.
I don't think this elite is wanting anybody to come in 5 years hence. Actually, I think the idea is to have, and I don't know, but my guess is that their idea is to prep a sub elite that will rise in more like 10 to 20 years hence, right?
Which is fine, if you believe this regime.
Well, this is the question. I mean, on one hand, you can get this kind of peaceful transition from the class of 38 to the Gorbachev generation, for example, was one such generational shift, right, that happened in Soviet politics. And it resulted in an entirely different kind of politics, as we all know now. When the Gorbachev generation came to power, their ideas were quite different from the class of 38's generation. You have to wonder if this new how Putinist is this new is would the new generation be. The other option is that this regime doesn't last that long, and that's what you seem to think, Mark, and it gets cannibalized, right? Is those are the two options we basically have.
I think actually the sort of these two are not mutually exclusive, in the sense of precisely I think this new generation depends really what we think of as Putinist. If Putinist means a kind of a grand imperial mission, which I think is what it means these days, it's certainly in terms of how Putin sees it these days, of building a new Russia that is sovereign, connected, but independent from the rest of the world, as if you can do that. I think this actual new generation is nothing to do with that, really. Oh, sure, they may mouth what they need to mouth, but basically speaking, they're about a good life, a comfortable life, acquisition, prosperity, that kind of thing. They are kleptocrats rather than, in my opinion, ideologues.
Hmm. Sean, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I haven't, of course, I haven't been watching to see who's kind of being plucked up and brought to Moscow and put in positions from the provinces, let's say. I mean, which was a feature of the early Bolshevik Party. I mean, the dynamism of social mobility in the 1920s and 1930s was massive. I mean, the Stalin's team just kind of plucked people out of obscurity and placed them in positions of authority and power. And it was, to some extent, you know, from their perspective, quite effective. But the question for the elite, the Putin elite, the governing elite, and I think we should make a distinction between the governing elite versus the kind of aristocratic elite of wealth. The governing elite, it would be interesting to see who are Putin's people bringing into their offices. And if they're grooming, what's their circle? Because we have a tendency to kind of look at the circle that orbits Putin. But what about the circles that orbit his people?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the question I wonder of, like, how deep does this kind of, you know, in looking at Russia in terms of patron-client relationships, the top level is clear. The bottom levels after that, I think, are the big question, because if there's any kind of government governing elite that's going to replace this generation, it's going to come from there.
Now, before we move on to the second half, I wanted to just throw this out to you, the question I posed at the very beginning. I mean, again, Sean, you're correct. We're talking about two different things here, the kind of the accumulation of wealth by this aristocratic class as described by the Reuters piece. But that piece implied that it was creating this kind of economic and political dynasty. It seemed to imply that. Navalny's comments in it seemed to imply it. And Gudkov's argument that this is doomed. What are the prospects for the current governing elite and their children? Will their children end up all living abroad, as Gudkov described the children of so many previous Soviet and Russian elites as living and dying abroad?
I think that remains to be seen how the negotiations of transfer of power goes.
What do you mean in terms of?
Because there are no rules, and by this I mean formal legal rules, but also informal rules. The transfer of power will take place, and inevitably, and how that will happen will be negotiated. Mm-hmm. What happens to me after, okay, I lost, it's time for me to go. What guarantees, if any, do I get, and what guarantees do I get for my children?
That's the more kind of peaceful and civilized variant,
or this goes down
in a very violent way.
I think goes to Mark's point about what is the economic situation and how do you divide up the resources. I mean, this is why I say that, you know, I used to not see Russia this way, but I think it does have tendencies to a kind of feudal model. In this sense, in terms of like wealth is contingent upon your political position. Is that wealth guaranteed by some structures outside of the guarantees of the leader, the person that is on top of the pyramid? It's and this jockeying of transferring of wealth and power, what is that contingent upon? Without those rules, it's basically this kind of everyone is fighting for their position based on the size of the pie.
What does your instinct tell you? This is going to go down in a more kind of negotiated and civilized way, or it's going to go down in a more cannibalized way?
You know, I don't know. I don't like to make this kind
I'm on the fence on this one too, actually.
Because I think it all depends on the domestic situation in terms of the economy and also the international situation.
Yeah.
So for example, if you look at, say, to take a very extreme example of the terror came in an international context in which the Soviet Union felt under threat from abroad. And that created the sense and the paranoia of a kind of fifth column, and you had to basically decapitate, potential threats within the party, which I think is something that's often lost when talking about the terror. It was more – you had more of a chance of being eliminated if you were in the party than outside of it. Yeah.
At least in the early stages of the terror.
Yeah.
Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, honestly, actually, I'm not entirely convinced that the decapitations within the party that were absolute and extensive were necessarily that much about external threat. I mean, I think even if there'd been no threat, Stalin was not going to allow any potential rivals. And that actually, I think, sort of speaks to this issue of transition. I don't actually think that there's going to be this bloodletting, actual or metaphorical, when we see a transition of power. I mean, there will no doubt be some people who lose out, and a lot of people who will be sort of taken to account, brought to account about their actions. But that's different from the sort of random purges and the elimination of a class. I think it's going to be much more negotiated. And one of the interesting things is the extent to which, although, shall we say, the psychology of power within Russia is indeed still feudal, still this notion that basically the state controls everything, actually, the way the world is changing is beginning to de facto change that. I mean, where are the, the retirement plans for the elite in this situation? Well, the answer is, whereas once upon a time it was nowhere, it was just staying in power. Now, actually, the outside world is in part the retirement plan. You can and do move money and resources abroad, which means that you will have some kind of recourse, even if you lose everything in Russia. So you actually have some degree of security. Mm. Secondly, I mean, although in many ways this is a regime that has shown itself willing to not just shoot itself in the foot, but blow its foot off with multiple salvos, the bottom line is that if you continue to operate in an expropriative way, foreign direct investment becomes almost impossible to get. Actually, your relationship with the rest of the world is influenced by how you deal with your own elite, given the extent to which nowadays money, ownership, and so forth becomes a sort of a global web work. So I think that, given that my view is anyway that, as it were, the next regime will still be pretty kleptocratic, just kleptocratic in a less aggressive, mm-hmm. externally way, and much more concerned about basically raking in the money and holding on to it, they actually have an incentive not to be too violent, not to be too vicious, and to show themselves as being, more of a kind of conventional, exploitative form. But I mean, on this point, I could just go back very briefly to something that Sean said, I think, which was spot on about wondering who the sort of the circles of the current senior, as it were, the barons and the earls, who their people are. And again, I mean, it's something that would actually be very difficult to do. I mean, I'd love it if anyone out there thinking of a PhD topic. You know, doing effectively a sort of a Minchenko Politburo 2.0, but actually on a ministry or one particular administration or whatever, sort of part of this, rather than, as we all tend to do, looking at the very senior figures, would be absolutely fascinating. And I think what it would show is that absolutely everyone brings sort of their own people in, but that probably we will be seeing a diversification or a sort of a distancing between people who are primarily motivated by patronage or whose appointments are motivated by patronage and bringing their clients, and people who are motivated by just bringing in people who are good at their job and actually elevating within the system. And I think this would actually speak to one of the fault lines within the elite between, as it were, the people who are primarily professional but also want to live a good life, but they are primarily professional, and people who are primarily political and kleptocratic, and for whom efficiency is definitely of a secondary.
Back to our old shareholders and managers dichotomy that we used to play with early on. Incidentally, Mark, on your comment that the outside world is the retirement plan, I saw a report on Deutsche TV just before I went in the studio that the Duma is considering reintroducing exit visas. It's just charming, yeah. So, well, on that note, we'll shift gears. In a moment, we'll continue our discussion and switch from the nobility to the masses. Russians are disengaged from politics, but at the same time, protest activity is ticking upward. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog, and host of the SRB podcast. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Петр Павленский, который называет себя художником...
Поджог один из входов здания ФСБ на Лубянке. Его задержали на месте
преступления. Его обвиняют в вандализме по политическим мотивам.
Западная пресса очень любит подобные акции.
Десятки больших грузов встали сегодня на обочине на подъездах.
Российские дальнобойщики бунтуют. Сегодня утром тягачи перекрыли...
Well, there were two protests in the news this week. Петр Павленский's latest stunt got the most attention, setting fire to the doors of Lubyanka. But the other protest was a nationwide uprising of truckers who set up roadblocks to protest a new tax on 12-ton vehicles. A report by the Center for Civic Initiatives, meanwhile, released this week, noted that protest activity across Russia has increased by 15% in the first 6 months of this year as opposed to the first 6 months of last year. Also this week, however, the Levada Center released a poll showing that 60% of Russians were indifferent to politics and only 10% were prepared to take part in street protests. What does this all say about public opinion and where it might go? I mean, these things seem at first glance to be contradictory. Perhaps they're not. Mark, Sean, either of you, go ahead.
I'm happy to try and square that circle a bit. I mean, if one looks at the Levada poll first, 60% Russians indifferent to politics. Well, I mean, apart from the fact that I'd be interested to know what a comparable poll in say, the United States would say. But I think there's a difference between, as it were, politics, what they regard as politics, which is basically what's being said in the Duma, let's say, and realities of day-to-day life, which we all know are the offshoot of politics. Mm-hmm. But I think, in a way, we tend to disconnect the two. And secondly, just 10% willing to take to the streets. Well, I'm not sure if I'd say just 10% in a regime like this. Actually, 10% of Russians is quite a lot. And therefore, if one looks at that very interesting Committee of Civic Initiatives survey. It's worth mentioning that this is, after all, an organization that Kudrin...
This is Kudrin's organization, exactly.
Yes, the number of protests was up 15%. They actually very sort of carefully wanted to say that they weren't assessing how many people were involved. Right. And I think actually sort of parsing this, it's interesting because I think on the one hand, this represents what I've felt has been one of the still untold stories, which is labor unrest. Which I think this is definitely something, because it's labor unrest is not just something that speaks to people's real concerns. It's a way of, as it were, protesting politics without protesting politics. You focus on a very specific local issue, but actually part of the subtext often, whether you're aware of it or not, is bigger national issues. Secondly, it's about, I think, fragmentation. It's not about 100,000 people on Bolotnaya. It's about 50 people here, 500 people there, 2 days, 1 day. You know, it's lots and lots of small things, none of which in and of themselves make the news, because very little of it is in Moscow. It's not in itself an existential challenge to the Russian state, but on the other hand, it builds up an increasingly sort of brittle social context. And the third and final point I'd make is actually, it's quite interesting if you look at where the protests are most focused. In the regions, it's Moscow, it's St. Petersburg, it's Novosibirsk, it's Transbaikal. So it's not like this is all about the poorest areas. It's not about this is all about the sort of the deindustrializing areas. In some ways, it's areas that are actually sort of heartland areas, but also where there's probably the greatest disproportions. In other words, you know, take Moscow region. Moscow, this extraordinarily vibrant, dynamic, and rich capital, in part because it has drained the blood out of most of the rest of European Russia. I think it's a sort of classic issues that actually it's not so much poverty and hardship that create problems. It's relative poverty and relative.
That's how it always is. Relative deprivation has always been the cause of protest. I mean, that's for sure. Sean, your thoughts?
I don't know what to make of these kinds of figures and this quantification of the number of protests versus this year and last year, and it's 15% more. It could be a factor of, you know, the pressures of economic conditions or various issues that come up, like the protests against taxes and for the truckers. I don't know what this means in general, and I don't know like how many people came out, what type of protest, what does it mean to protest? This all makes kind of, it's very vague, but nevertheless, the it does create the question of, and I think this is something that those of us who watch Russia generally and report on Russia have been really negligent in, and that is trying to figure out what Russians on the street think about the society around them. We have lots of reporting on the elite. We have lots of reporting on kind of the high politics. And we have lots of reporting on propaganda. And there's this assumption that propaganda is shaping the minds of Russians and regular Russians. And we're essentially not giving regular Russians much agency in kind of determining their lives. So I think what this kind of study does is pose that question of, well, what is going on down there on the ground? How do people engage their daily lives? What does it mean to be engaged in politics or not in politics? So I think it raises more questions than it provides answers.
And I think the subtext of all of this is something that's it's much discussed. I mean, the famous dichotomy between the refrigerator and the television, the two household appliances battling for the heart for the souls of Russians. It points to the dichotomy between Putin's nearly 90% approval rating and the fact that the very same polls show big majorities of Russians unhappy with the direction of policy at the same time. It points to a couple of disconnects, and one has to wonder, how do you square that circle? Any ideas there?
Well, I'll have a guess. I think this dichotomy of fridge versus television is actually a false one, because, as it were, the television is, yes, presenting a certain vision, but it also very much it is posing to Russians the imperial czarship of Putin. And I think, actually, Russians in the main are responding to that and have responded to that. But they are also aware that their fridge is looking a bit bare. And therefore, I think it's not...
So the
not
fridge and the television exist in different worlds, so to speak, different zones
exactly.
of the brain.
I mean, television, you know, and we use that as the sort of the metaphor...
That's the metaphor for the
propaganda campaign and so forth. You know, it's not actually telling you that the Ministry of Transport is doing a jolly good job. it's not going into that kind of granular stuff. It sticks to this very, very big picture. And the point is, I don't actually think there is genuinely a contradiction between thinking, yes, let's go and blast those awful jihadists of ISIS in Syria, because after all, that's what they'd been told Russian planes are doing. And at the same time, feeling unhappy because, life is getting harder, your wage in real terms is decreasing, etc. And therefore, I think that this notion, after all, that Russians will put up with any miseries in the name of Russian nationalism and so forth, is actually a bit of pernicious Orientalism. Mm-hmm. Of course, they will.
No, I never bought that.
No, yeah. Exactly. I mean, but that is a very, very potent meme, to be honest, on this, especially on this side of the Atlantic. The point is, yes, of course, Russians will defend the motherland if it's under existential threat, but it's not under existential threat in any way. It is, as it were, if there is an existential threat, it is to the elite.
Well, the elite's trying to convince the masses that the motherland's under existential threat.
Yeah, but it's actually very hard, I think, to make the case genuinely that actually there is something. This is not quite the same as having, you know, German forces advancing across your border. I mean, that is the stuff of which real existential threats are made. So I think, you know, from Russia's point of view, given that actually it's very hard to sell the idea that everything is fine. This is not the days when Pravda would put out the data that says the harvest is wonderful and, by the way, they're starving in the streets of Manchester. And Russians had no way really of, or Soviets rather, had no way really of sort of checking that. You know, Soviet citizens are, you know, even sort of factory worker or whatever, who may not tune in to Deutsche Welle and that kind of thing, but nonetheless, you know, has a sense of the outside world just from watching soap operas on television or whatever else, has a sense that his or her life is getting harder at the moment. And what the TV has done, I think, has successfully disconnected Putin from the state apparatus.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's not the same as saying it's actually won support for the state apparatus.
Yeah, but it's the state apparatus is going to be there no matter what. It's the group on top around Putin that is in question. And Putin.
But even then, I mean, I don't think I get no sense that people are saying, wow, that Ivanov, what a lovely guy.
No, they don't have to. They don't have to.
Very, very specifically Putin. And in some ways, I think Putin's strength is that he is incorrectly not seen as part of the governing apparatus in so many ways.
But de facto, his popularity protects the collective Putin. Right?
Does it?
As long as they remain in Putin's good graces, the it does.
Well, I mean, as long as they remain in good graces, they stay in their position. But it doesn't mean to say that ordinary Russians think, well, if Putin sees something in that Ivanov chap, then he must be a fine fellow. I mean, again, if we go back to the history, and with all the dangers of the historical analogies, but how far is this that actually you can be a very discontented Russian peasant and yet still think that the Tsar is appointed by God and therefore must ultimately, it must just simply be that he doesn't know what's going on. The irony is, of course, that they're probably right.
Right. Well,
May I add something in? Or, you know, be concerned about the big political issues that govern the country. I mean, most people, you know, they may grumble about the leadership or they may fawn over the leadership, but when they step outside of their door, they're seeing the kind of everyday things, you know, the conditions of the road, access to healthcare, access to education for their children, their state of their employment. I think probably if you look at the content, my guess is, and I haven't done this, but my guess is if you look at a lot of the content of the protests, they tend to be around these kind of more economist ideas, these things that directly affect their everyday life or they feel they affect their everyday life. The labor unrest, for example, which, yes, as Mark is correct, it is challenging the system as a whole. But the target of that protest is at a very low level
Nobody makes the connection to, and this actually gets at something I, go ahead.
And this is the issue of which, say, and we haven't talked about oppositional forces and leadership in Russia for a long time,
for a good reason.
But this is the goal of those people. If they want to affect change in Russia, that's the connections that they have to make as so-called oppositionist leaders. And, you know, this has been, I think, one of the shortfalls of this leadership to some extent, not in all cases,
right,
but to some extent.
I mean, the way the kind of dichotomy between Putin's 90% rating, which I think de facto translates into that for the regime, right? And the fact that most of the country is actually discontent with the way things are actually working. The way that's been explained is that Putin is this, you know, as Mark, you suggested, Putin's this symbol of the nation. He's able to float above this as the czar appointed by God. But one has to wonder when, how long that can be sustained. No? I mean, can he sustain that forever? I'm not sure.
I suppose he can't, but in some ways, I wonder actually how relevant or important it is. In some ways, I mean, this is a two-edged sword. By floating above it as this national icon of Russia and manhood and bear wrestling and whatever else, he protects himself from the opprobrium based on day-to-day life and discontent with local authorities and national authorities and everything else. But on the other hand, it also means that he cannot protect that system. I mean, either he's part of the system or he's not. He doesn't actually, I would suggest, in the long term, get to pick and choose. And therefore, people can actually say, I don't think we'll get a repeat of Bloody Sunday and the idea that if only we can get this petition to the Tsar and tell him how we're really suffering, then the Tsar will fix it. I mean, you know, I don't believe is going to happen. But nonetheless, the basic point that actually Putin has moved himself to a position whereby he is both safe and, in this respect, almost impotent, I think is worth stressing. And I mean, when we talk about opposition forces, I mean, although by no meaningful way can actually one talk about the Communist Party as an opposition force. Certainly, all the upper figures are happy to have been co-opted as the tame, fake opposition. And I think if Zyuganov was actually offered the opportunity to become president, I think he would run a mile. But I thought it was fascinating that he made the case recently in public speech for a referendum on the expropriation of oligarch property. And on one level, absolutely, this is just the
theatrics.
Theater.
Yeah, this is theater.
Nonetheless, I mean, I can't help but wonder how long can you continue to make such kind of inflammatory talk without assuming that the popular mood continues to be discontented with the status quo, without then at some point people actually taking you at face value and not therefore thinking, well, that's Zyuganov, he's a young firebrand we want to go for, but nonetheless beginning to actually imbibe the rhetoric. I mean, I think here we're beginning to see some of the contradictions of what was still, after all, the Sokovian model of creating a whole, dramaturgical, sort of theatrical model of politics, that you have a father of a nation, that you have a government that is in a way separate, and that you have the trappings of opposition. I think all of these are beginning to come under stress at the moment.
What about the non-systemic opposition?
I'll let you know when I find it. I mean, I think this is the problem. At the moment, there isn't any that sort of comes to our radar screens, because precisely, you know, it's not the Navalny's.
He hasn't stopped doing what he's doing.
Exactly, but I mean,
but nobody's paying. Well, people aren't paying attention.
Attraction, you know, he hasn't made that sort of connection.
He just exposed Shoigu's palace and everything. You know.
And that's why it had such a dramatic and seismic impact on Shoigu. I mean, you know, this doesn't actually matter. I mean, telling Russians your elite is corrupt does not count, I think, as a revelation.
I'll tell you, we did Current Time Television did some vox pops on this, and it was pretty interesting. It was like, oh, Shoigu should have a big house like that. Why? This is like everybody was. We only have one Shoigu. Let him have a nice house. Look what he's done for the army. These were the vox pops you were getting on the street.
Exactly. I mean, I think that is not the issue. And in some ways, actually, from Shoigu. Shoigu is it's a very hard target, because he is sometimes regarded as having earned his position and his rights. I mean, I think actually you'll claw down a lot of people before you actually get to Shoigu. But going back to this business of where is the non-systemic opposition, you know, and it's not Puro Daltsov still languishing in house arrest, being written about by no Western journalists, because who wants to talk about a firebrand communist? It's actually precisely, it's going to be out there on shop floors, in local community organizations and so forth, probably away from Moscow.
But
largely.
Somebody's got to harness it.
Somebody has got to harness it. For it to become a movement, you know, for there to be the solidarity movement or whatever. But on the other hand, it doesn't stop it from nibbling away and worrying people. And when we come back again, if we sort of loop back to what we were talking about in the first half of the podcast about the elite and about how the elite are feeling and so forth. You know, you can be very, very happy with your brand new walk-in fridge freezer or whatever sort of particular, you know, toy you've just bought yourself from the West. But if you feel that the system is beginning to get out of control, if you begin to feel that, in fact, there is some kind of primordial bunt, some primordial peasant uprising, shall we say, waiting in the wings, that's something that might get you thinking seriously about where you think the future is going.
Well, and this actually points to something that I've often thought, is that the non-systemic opposition does its best when it does, when it hooks up with a wing of the elite that is not happy with how things are going. That's when you tend to see movement, right, historically. Sean, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I have a question about the Communist Party, actually, because, you know, the Zhuganov, it's a mess in this sense.
Well, I mean, he was going to be replaced, actually.
Yeah, and there's been talk of him being replaced for a while. I mean, remember, there was a bit of talk that Udaltsov would take over for Zhuganov. But it does raise
the ultimate co-optation.
Right, because from my understanding, for a while in the lower rungs of the Communist Party, and the question is if you're a politician, why are you part of the Communist Party? Right? I mean, especially out there in the provinces. The question is, okay, once the leadership, this kind of old geriatric leadership that's bought by the system, is it goes its merry way, what about the lower rungs of the party? And there's been a struggle for a while about a more radical contingent in the lower rungs of the Communist Party that actually wants to transform it into some kind of more, you know, not a completely non-systemic oppositional force, but at least in terms of some kind of real opposition force within the government. So it would be interesting to see how that plays out, particularly if, you know, out in the countryside, you know, more people are kind of feeling disgruntled about their everyday, you know, social and economic condition, and how politicians on the ground can utilize that discontent, at least on the local level in terms of local politics.
Mm. Can I actually jump in just on the Communist Party? I mean, something that I've said in the past, and I still believe, it's really worth noting that however much its central elite is co-opted, the Communist Party still has the only working nationwide political machine that is not under direct Kremlin control. And fine, it may depend largely on 70-year-old Babushki, but never, ever, ever underestimate Russian 70-year-old Babushki.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is actually, at least some of the pictures I've seen of labor protests out in the provinces have included people waving red flags and so forth. Now, they may not have been representatives of the Communist Party, but there clearly is a vestigial sense that it's there and the potentiality for a connection. And again, absolutely, if I were the sort of person who wants to join the Communist Party out in wherever, you know, some middle-ranking city out in the provinces, I'm probably not doing it because I think I'm going to be the next generation of Zhuganovs who will live a pampered life in Moscow. I presume I'm doing it because I have some kind of ideological commitment to struggle. And one wonders at what point is there also the risk of defection? That even if Zhuganov is still only playing the role of opposition, at what point do you find the local Communist Party saying, well, actually...
They believe the hype.
Well, not even believe the hype, but they believe their own beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
That they actually think, well, ultimately, with whom should I be allying? Zhuganov or actually the struggling workers in my local community who still have some kind of belief in the ideology, which is hard to see Zhuganov as having. You know, I think that's definitely a possibility. Mm. Very hard to know.
We're bumping up against the end here. I want to throw one more thing out before I know you got to go, Sean. I got to throw one more thing out at you both. Same question at the end of the section we did on the elite. Where do you think it's going? Where do you see this moving? Do we expect to see a bubbling up of protests reaching some kind of critical mass or not?
It's, of course, you know, I'm going to cop out and say it's hard to say, but I think perhaps people like us should pay attention to some of the reforms going on that are essentially mostly neoliberal in content, and the reforms of transforming the healthcare system to a fees to service, the issues of labor, educational reform, and how this is going to play out on the lower levels of society. I think for too long, there's been too much emphasis on the top politics of Russia and Putin, in particular, and not enough kind of looking at what's going on in society and playing to this meme that Mark points out that we think that Russians are essentially kind of anesthetized by all of this propaganda, and that their commitment and support for the state or the Putin in particular doesn't mean that they, you know, have problems with the system.
Yeah, and yeah, I think you're right that most of the protests we've seen, and it's worth noting, the protest that spooked the Kremlin more than any up until the Bolotnaya protests was the one over the monetization of social benefits.
Right.
That was the thing that spooked them the most. Mark, your last thoughts?
Yeah, I definitely agree with Sean. And the interesting and depressing thing is that even if the economy begins to recover next year, and that's
a big if,
distinctly uncertain, and even if it does begin to, I mean, really, the best that they can hope for is for it to bottom out. The thing is, a lot of the decisions that have been made, even already, about spending and in the social sector are going to play out over time. They're not things that necessarily have a bang, instant impact. They're things that actually have a slow, debilitating effect, and you know, it's kind of shades of Brezhnevism in that respect. The health system, the education system, the money that has been taken from the pension fund. You know, all of this is going to have a long-term effect. So I don't actually think we're going to see any reversal of this trend. I think we are going to see more protests and such like. I don't think we're going to see some kind of critical mass. I don't think we unless there's something quite dramatic to trigger it. You know, again, play the historical parallels, 1905 or something like that. But basically, you know, assuming that nothing cataclysmic like that happened, and it's unlikely, but you know, some banking, you know, systemic banking collapse or something. But I don't think it's going to happen. Instead, I think that if you see a kind of a growing tension, a growing pressure in the countryside and the provinces, if you begin to see actually elements either of the Communist Party or others beginning to actually actively politicize it, it has an effect on the elites. I mean, in this respect, I am, just as I am in all other aspects of my life, an elitist. I do think ultimately politics matters. You know, it is the elite. It is whether the elite fractures, whether elements of the elite begin to actually defect from the current regime or look for changes, or whether the elite as a whole begin to decide that brand Putin has become tarnished. Mm-hmm. In part, that's about the international situation, whether they can go shopping in Milan or not. But also in part, it's whether or not they feel that in the classic conservative, smart conservatives mold, reform that you may preserve, they feel they have to do something. So I very much see we're going to see the feedback loop between what's happening with the masses and what's happening with these pampered elites.
Yeah, when you look at the macro situation, I mean, the pie's shrinking, right? The kleptocracy is not going to stop being a kleptocracy. The military buildup's not going to stop being a military buildup. The money's got to be taken from somewhere, and that's quite obvious where that's going to be from. And you have to wonder how the masses are going to respond to this. I don't think the situation is sustainable, quite frankly. Those would be my final thoughts. And on that note, we will wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog, and host of the SRB podcast, which I had the honor of appearing on yesterday. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Yes, thank you.
And I'd like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, senior producer at RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, who is now tweeting under the handle at Pasha Butorin, and it's as awesome as ever. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.